the most advanced home gaming system in the universe, this do-it-all dynamo would also play movies, music, and CD-ROM content. Although this sounded overly ambitious, if there was anyone who could pull it off, it was Trip Hawkins, the founder of Electronic Arts, who believed so much in this grand new vision that he was willing to abandon the software company he had started from scratch. Even more ambitiously, his 3DO company wouldn't manufacture the hardware itself, like Sega and Nintendo both did, but would instead license the technology, the incentive being that while these manufacturers would have to bear expensive production costs, they would only have to pay very low royalty rates. In 1983, Hawkins had founded Electronic Arts to disrupt the software industry, and now, 10 years later, he was looking to do the same with hardware. Release date, fall 1993. 2. Atari. After sitting on the sidelines for many years, Atari planned to return to the console business with a bang. So while everyone else was just starting to think about 32-bits, they were preparing for the launch of their 64-bit system called the Jaguar. Nobody knew quite what to expect from the return of Atari, but the system's "Do the Math" slogan indicated that Atari was counting on its pedigree and standing out when it came to bits and bytes. Release date, November 1993. 3. NEC. In October 1989, Sega launched the Genesis, and NEC launched the TurboGrafx. Of the two 16-bit consoles, Nintendo was more worried about the latter because of NEC's enormous financial resources. A bad launch lineup, poor marketing, and the long shadow of Nintendo had quickly doomed the TurboGrafx, but NEC seemed to have learned from that experience, just as Sega had learned from the failure of their Master System, and was ready to get back in the game. By the middle of 1992, NEC had developed a 32-bit system architecture called Iron Man, which earned rave reviews behind the scenes at the Consumer Electronics Show. Release date, early 1994. 4. Bandai. Although Bandai had no experience in the video game industry, they were the third largest toy company in the world, behind Hasbro and Mattel, which automatically equipped them with three important advantages: brand recognition, top-tier intellectual properties, and strong distribution networks. Given these assets, Bandai began working on a console code named BAX, which they designed to target a young demographic through edutainment and anime content. Release date, late 1994. 5. Sony. Following the failed romance with Sony, Nintendo had little idea what the company was up to. Rumors circulated that Sony was serious about moving forward on their own, and there appeared to be some truth to this, as evidenced by Norio Oga's shielding Ken Kutaragi and moving him under the umbrella of Sony Music. Although this may have given the PlayStation a stay of execution, it was hard for Nintendo to imagine that Sony would actually take this project all the way. Unless they had the support of a stable partner who knew the video game business, they risked another Betamax debacle. And now that Nintendo was out of the running, that left only Sega. But there had been no whispers of any such relationship, and an alliance like that was simply too big to keep quiet. Release date? TBD. Each of these potential competitors had a nuanced set of strengths and weaknesses, and of course not all of them would flourish. But even if just one made a serious dent in the market, then the pie that Nintendo once had feasted on all by itself would be split into three pieces instead of two. Given the lucrative nature of the video game business, a more populated pie-eating contest seemed all but an inevitability. And it was for this reason that, in these changing times, Arakawa was even more committed to staying the course and maintaining Nintendo's identity. Tweaks could be made, but in a coming war between style and substance, it was important that Nintendo remain more substantial than ever. "Can we at least discuss the magazine?" White asked, hoping to leave the room with some sort of concession, even something small. He had unsuccessfully broached this topic before, but figured that with the research results, now would be a good time to try again. "Nintendo Power is great, and I know Gail has done a great job. We can all see that it's, you know, great. But we have to recognize that by hoarding all of the secrets to our games, it's really pissing off the other magazines, and with that, lots of people in the industry. And let's face it, that's one of the areas where Sega really torched us." Although Arakawa often took long moments to juggle pros and cons, or at least to make it appear that way, he did not like to be challenged in this manner, and his answer to White was brisk. No, he shook his head. There is nothing of this matter to discuss. In lieu of a conversation, a stiff tension permeated the room. White wanted to shout something back, at least to spur discussion, but he knew there was nothing he could possibly say that would open up Arakawa's mind, and that only made him want to shout even more. But it was pointless, and everyone there could feel the staggering lack of efficacy. As if to break up the subtly uncomfortable mood, the representative from MDC offered some optimism. "It's not all bad news. We did find some signs of progress," he said, quickly glancing at the papers in his hand. "More girls between the ages of 6 and 14 are becoming primary players. And of all the people we surveyed, 96% knew who Mario was, and 83% of people said that they liked him." It wasn't enough to put minds at ease, but it was enough to unknot everyone's stomachs. And it served as a reminder that beneath the numbers, Nintendo always had the advantage of Mario and everything he represented. Miyamoto's genius, and the no-nonsense perseverance that had enabled NOA to resurrect an industry from the ashes. Defeating Sega would require a recommitment to many of the same values, focus, belief, and the confidence to follow a vision in the face of adversity. This was what made Nintendo so wonderfully successful in the past, from playing cards to video games, and this strategy to double down on substance over style likely would have worked. If not, what for Sega did next? Chapter 43, Magic Carpet Ride. Being a grown-up was not supposed to be this much fun. Being a kid? Probably. Being a college student? Definitely. But being a grown-up? No way. That was supposed to be nothing more than pushing papers, rolling eyes, and constantly struggling against a slew of unwanted responsibilities. Being a grown-up, especially one with a corporate job, was supposed to be the beginning of the end. But for Diana Dare, who was flying to the Mojave Desert in order to film Sega's newest commercial, being a grown-up felt like nothing less than the beginning of a wonderful new beginning. Personally and professionally, there were changes everywhere, but none more emblematic than that of her name. It had all started about a year ago, just prior to Christmas 1991, with an occasion that included a teddy bear, a persistent doorbell, and, with a strange symbolic appropriateness, a fat lady singing. It was Saturday, December 14th, and Diana Dare was into the final hours of planning a surprise party for her boyfriend Don. The plan was that while he was at Candlestick Park watching Steve Young dismantle Kansas City, she would decorate the house, welcome guests, and entertain family and friends until the fateful shout of surprise. It was perfect. Or would have been if Don hadn't gone ahead and ruined her plans for his birthday party. "You're going to be late," she said, trying to hustle him out of the door. I know, he said, resisting the light pushes on his elbow. "But first I need you to go to the Christmas tree. Beau is over there, and it looks like he's got something for you. You know how impatient he can be." Beau was a fluffy, tan-colored teddy bear that Don had given to Diane at a Christmas party 2 years earlier. It was the first formal event they'd attended together, and in a strange way, the tan-stuffed bear came to represent the formalization of their affections. Beau held a special place in their hearts, an inanimate pet that only the two of them could fully appreciate. On Don's instructions, Diane walked toward the Christmas tree and saw that there was a small jewelry box resting right below the bear's spiffy black bow tie. An early Christmas gift? How thoughtful. But couldn't he just have waited 11 more days? Well, the quicker she opened this, the quicker he would leave, and she could get on with planning his party. But all thoughts about the surprise party were trumped by the surprise she felt when she opened the box, saw the ring, and then looked up to see Don getting down on one knee and asking her if she would marry him. "So," he concluded, "what do you say?" Tears welled up in her eyes, but before Diane could answer the question, the doorbell rang. It was Don's best friend, ready to take him to the game, so eager to get going that he quickly rang the doorbell twice more before poking his head in the doorway. "Don, you ready?" he asked, before he noticed Diane crying and apologized profusely. "Sorry, I didn't realize you were fighting. I'll just come back in a little while." "No," Diane said, trying to explain the situation. But before she could do that, Don pressed her for an answer, especially since the only thing she had said since he had asked was no. "Yes, of course," she said, smiling and laughing. But before she could embrace her husband-to-be, the doorbell once again rang. This time Don answered it, intending to clarify the situation for his friend, but when he opened the door, he found instead an obese woman dressed in a Viking costume. He said, because there's really nothing else appropriate to say under these circumstances. Diane had hired this woman to sing at the party this evening, but apparently she had arrived early and knew how to embrace the moment. And as the 200-plus-pound Viking woman launched into an over-the-top operatic version of Happy Birthday, there was really nothing appropriate for Diane to say under these circumstances except for... surprise! They got married 9 months later, on September 12th, 1992. A wonderful day that began with Diane Adair and ended with Diane Fernassier. She had gladly taken his name, and then taken a honeymoon in France, which seemed to metaphorically represent her transition from giver to taker. All her life, Diane Adair had been a giver, the kind of person who instinctively shares credit, who sincerely believes in the golden rule, and who would actually give someone in need the shirt off her back, if such a thing were socially acceptable for girls. Some might argue that her altruism was inspiring, while others might argue that it was naive. But Diane didn't care all that much because she didn't want to argue at all. Conflict was okay if it came to that. But shouting, shoving, and winning first place in the blame game didn't get her juices going. Besides, needless conflict got in the way of giving 100% toward the task at hand. But over the past couple of years, a change had taken place within her. It began with her taking the job at Sega, grew when she took on Nintendo, Game Gear versus Game Boy, and was finalized by taking Don's name. This evolution of confidence and self-esteem was then confirmed once again when Diane Fernassier took over Al Nilsson's responsibilities and was put in charge of marketing the Genesis. Although Sega's marketing department had already developed a scintillating reputation for shock and awe, Fernassier's tenure on the Genesis would begin with a shot heard round the world type of bang. Following the launch of the Welcome to the Next Level campaign, the team at SOA could not have been any happier with how they had successfully redefined the Sega brand and, simultaneously, positioned Nintendo. Amazingly, Nintendo had not yet fought back, which only further enabled Sega to paint them into a kiddie-sized corner. As a result, Sega felt like they were dominating Nintendo on every front in the advertising war except for one, technology. They didn't think they were losing this battle. Sega CD promised the future, and Sonic Speed exemplified the present. But Sega's next-level thinking wasn't content with just winning. It was about winning big. And the only thing standing in the way of total domination was Mode 7. Ever since the release of Super Mario Kart, Nintendo had made a noticeable effort to tout their 16-bit system's Mode 7 technology, which enabled the console to display some rudimentary 3D graphics. Although technological jargon often has a way of eluding mainstream consumers, Nintendo's Mode 7 resonated with a wide enough audience to cause SOA's marketing department to ask, "Do we have that?" When the answer came back no, the marketing department scrambled to look for something, preferably something with an ad-friendly name, that the Genesis had and the SNES did not. To find a cool-sounding needle somewhere in Sega's haystack, Franz Tantiato, a member of Fornasier's group, met with a seasoned producer named Michael Latham. Although nothing immediately came to mind, Latham grabbed a hardware manual and began paging through it. "Surely there must be something," Tantiato suggested, "or how else could Sonic be so much faster than Mario?" While looking through the manual, Latham found something that kind of, sort of, maybe fit the bill. Burst mode, which in theory allowed the Genesis to process code faster than Nintendo's chip could. Although this sounded like exactly what the marketing team wanted, Latham explained that burst mode actually had very little to do with the graphics, velocity, and overall performance of Sega's games. To say that burst mode was the reason that Sonic could move so fast would be like saying that cheetahs were faster than elephants because of their spots. But still, it was something that Sega had and Nintendo did not, which was exactly what the marketing team had wanted. Tantiato loved the concept, but hated the name, which prompted Latham to brainstorm possible nicknames and eventually settle on Blast Processing. Although Blast Processing was really Burst Mode, which was really nothing more than the spots on a cheetah, this phrase went up the flagpole and caught fire internally, especially after Hiroshi Yamauchi announced that Nintendo had been developing something called the Super FX chip. From Jeff Goodby to Tom Kalinske, it seemed nearly everyone loved the idea of thumbing their nose at Nintendo by flaunting this magical blast processing. The lone voice of dissent came from Al Nilsson, who felt this crossed the line. There were so many positive things to say about Sega and the company's rags-to-riches story. Why resort to fiction? His concerns were noted and debated, but ultimately he was outvoted, and Sega chose to start deploying the phrase on Sonic Tuesday by having Dustin Diamond gush about Sega's blast processing capabilities. Following a positive response from the buzzword-loving mainstream press, this new term would come to embody the difference between Sega and Nintendo and serve as the focal point of a series of commercials to kick off 1993, which is precisely why Diane Fanassier was headed out to the Mojave Desert. The spot called for a long open road, which is exactly what Fanassier found when she arrived on the set. The highway where they would be filming looked almost exactly like it had in the storyboards, except that in real life, the road was surrounded by miles and miles of frosted desert terrain. Not ideal weather for those on set, but perfect for the ad they were shooting. Titled Top Fuel, it would begin with the Sega Genesis and Super Nintendo sitting in the middle of the road. The camera would then pan back and forth between the two, as a narrator explains that the Sega Genesis has blast processing, the Super Nintendo doesn't. And then asks the question that was on everyone's mind, because Sega had just put it there. So what does blast processing do? Answering that was the fun part, and it's why they had to shoot this in the middle of nowhere. How fast will it go? Fanassier asked, looking at the Formula One race car. About 150 miles per hour, one of the ad guys said. 160 if we're lucky. Fanassier was feeling lucky, but she knew that advertisers and clients always have a slightly different definition of this concept. Although both sides wanted the same thing, critical, commercial, and water cooler success, the agency guys would have been perfectly happy to accomplish that by not showing a single second of game footage. That's where Fanassier came in. Typically, someone in her position would farm out production work and avoid the desert's 30-degree winter temperature, but she wanted to be on set to ensure there was a semblance of substance to the agency's style. Just 160? Another ad guy asked. Nah, I heard that bad boy can sling it up to 170. Might not work in this weather, but it's definitely a possibility. I think 150 will be more than fine, Fanassier said. The centerpiece of the commercial, and the part that vaguely answered the question about the meaning of blast processing, was a television playing Sonic 2 attached to the back of the race car. And although it's fair to assume that the coolness of this aesthetic would increase with each additional mile per hour, Fanassier also knew that there would be an inverse relationship between the race car's velocity and a viewer's ability to figure out what the heck was playing on the TV. On second thought, there are no shots of the speedometer, so 140 might even be okay too. Oh, come on, the agency guys playfully exclaimed. Hey, Fanassier said, proudly taking charge. Back when I worked at Del Monte, my boss used to take out a stopwatch and count how many seconds it took for the logo to appear on screen. It's up to you guys how to film this, but if you want to try to break a speed record, then I'm bringing a stopwatch to the next shoot. The guys from Goodby made it work, as they always managed to do, and they made sure everyone had fun in the process. For the next several hours, they filmed the television-clad race car, and then they moved on to shoot the part that would piss off Nintendo. Not only had Sega chosen to fabricate something called blast processing, but they decided to end the commercial with one final insult. After the race car speeds off screen, the narrator returns with another question. And what if you don't have blast processing? As he speaks, the camera pans to a wimpy, blah-blah white milk truck on the side of the road. clunky thing can hardly get started. It's a piece of junk from bumper to bumper. But when it finally manages to lumber down the road, a television is revealed on this vehicle as well. And it's playing Super Mario Kart, the poor little racing game that now seems so slow by comparison. Just another victim blasted by Sega's marketing process. What Kalinske loved so much about blast processing was how perfectly it unified Sega's defenses for the coming year. Not only did it provide cover in the battle against Nintendo, but it also armed Sega with additional ammo to take down the slew of 32-bit consoles on the horizon, like Atari's Jaguar and Trip Hawkins' 3DO machine. Additionally, Kalinske was always hyper-conscious about the story that Sega was trying to sell to the world. And now that his company's underdog tale was reaching its climax, it was time to shift the narrative from the little engine that could to the engine that powered the video game industry. Blast processing fed right into the new storyline, and the best part was that if anyone tried to dismiss it, they'd be the ones cast as villains. If Nintendo or Atari or Trip Hawkins called out Sega and accused them of doing exactly what they had done, then they'd look like the jealous killjoy. Besides, they wouldn't be able to prove anything anyhow, because technically it was true. Genesis did have blast processing, which would go on to do so much for Sega, even though it actually did almost nothing at all. From a tactical standpoint, Sega appeared to be invincible in the short run. That mentality, however, began to change when Kalinske received a call from a psychologist named Arthur Pober. Wait, Kalinske said, speaking into his office phone. Why don't you slow down and start over again?
Sorry, Tom, Pober apologized. But it doesn't matter how slow I say it, because the fact remains the same. The United States government is looking to crack down on the video game industry.
The words made Kalinske momentarily numb. Please tell me this is a prank.
Unfortunately not, Pober said. I have this on good authority, and I suspected that you would appreciate this as a courtesy call from me to you.
Arthur Pober was a proudly blunt Brooklynite who was currently serving as director of the Children's Advertising Review Unit, CARU. Founded in 1974, CARU was a self-regulatory group that had been created to promote responsible children's advertising across various mediums, from commercials during Saturday morning cartoons to advertisements in the Sunday Circular. In effect, CARU was the advertising police, at least when it came to protecting children. But because this was a self-regulatory agency, its officers were typically members of the toy industry, which is why Tom Kalinske had been a member since Mattel asked him to join in 1978. Have you spoken to Howard? Kalinske asked. Sega's leader wasn't the only member of CARU. So was Howard Lincoln, who had been a member of the group since Nintendo's heyday.
Not yet, Pober said, but he's my next call.
Good, Kalinske said, hoping that Lincoln would be just as rattled as he was. In your expert opinion, what are we looking at here? How bad could this be?
Best case scenario, Pober mused. The government gets bored and stops nosing around. Worst case scenario, they hold congressional hearings and wind up regulating the gaming industry.
That would effectively kill the entire business.
Hey, you wanted to know how bad it could be.
Kalinske couldn't believe what he was hearing. But at the same time, it felt like the other shoe had finally dropped. Ever since his conversation with Emil Heidkamp at CES about the dangers posed by the increasing realism of video games, Kalinske had been feeling that this was only a matter of time. Do you know what prompted all of this?
I really don't know,
Pober explained.
But if I had to guess, it would be as a result of some recent commercials. I haven't seen them myself, but I keep hearing about subliminal messages and some kind of scream. Does that mean anything to you?
Kalinske shook his head. Of course it did. And as he weighed the gravity of this situation, he couldn't help but think back on the story of Prometheus, the Greek mythological figure who had stolen fire from the gods and delivered it to all of humanity. He had so nobly risked his life, but had done so for the sake of moving civilization forward. How much time, if you had to guess, do you think we've got before this hits the fan?
A lot, Pober said. And that's if anything even comes of this at all. Like I said at the beginning, these are just rumblings. Could be nothing.
Let's hope, Kalinske said, shaking his head. Pober agreed and then bid him adieu, leaving Kalinske alone in his office with only his thoughts of Prometheus. Now we remember the details from the second half of the story. After delivering the gift of fire and advancing humanity, Prometheus was punished by the deities for committing this terrible crime. How dare he bring the mortals one step closer to immortality? And how dare he think himself a hero to mankind when what he'd really done was to rob them of their beautiful ignorance? A price must be paid for this act of hubris, a heavy price indeed, and so Zeus, the god of gods, sentenced the thief to eternal torment for his irreversible transgression. Bound to a rock, the immortal Prometheus would be, and each day an eagle would descend from the heavens to feed on his liver, inflicting unspeakable pain. Prometheus would suffer like nothing ever before, but that physical toll would never compare to the pain of knowing that each night, without fail, his shredded liver would grow back, and each morning the eagle would return to repeat the cycle over and over until forever never came. The message was rather clear. The keepers of the world had a habit of punishing the champions of progress, and Kalinske vowed to do everything in his power to make sure that didn't happen. Howard Lincoln, however, felt like he had already done everything in his power. "It's not us," Lincoln explained to Arthur Pober. "I can tell you that much. We strictly monitor all of the content in our systems, every single second of it." "Hey," Pober said, "I'm not here to point fingers."
"I mean it," Lincoln continued. What better example of this was there than the case of Mortal Kombat? Both Sega and Nintendo had tried to get exclusive rights to the violent arcade game, but Acclaim, who owned the console rights to Midway's games, wanted to release it on both systems. That was Acclaim's choice, and that was fine. But just because Sega was going to release this gory game as is, didn't mean Nintendo would do the same. For the SNES version, Lincoln asked the developers to decrease the level of violence and substitute a bland gray sweat in place of the game's blazing red blood. This was not an easy decision, nor was it a business one. Lincoln knew that by watering down the violence, Nintendo's version would likely be outsold by the one Kalinske would be dealing. But just because it was more profitable, that didn't make it right. Lincoln knew that in the coming months there would be those who wondered who was right and who was wrong, but he didn't care at all about that, because he knew without question that for Nintendo, this was the only way. "God damn," Lincoln continued. "If it weren't for Nintendo, this industry would just be a bunch of pornography."
I know," Pober said. "But I still wanted to call out of courtesy. I doubt that anything will come of this, but you have a right to know what's going on."
"Thank you for doing so. I do appreciate the call," Lincoln said. "I am curious. Have you relayed this to my good friend Tom Kalinske?"
"Not yet," Pober said. "But he's my next call."
"Good," Lincoln said. For the past 2 years, Kalinske had been trying to label Nintendo as the Disney of video games. So Howard Lincoln couldn't help but take a little comfort in the fact that if anything came of this, he'd have the likes of Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, and Goofy in his corner.
"When you speak with Tom, you really ought to ask him how he's currently feeling about the notion of karma."
There was a lot of evidence to suggest that Nintendo really should be considered the Disney of video games. But in 1993, there was another developer who wanted to steal this moniker away from Nintendo, and that was the actual Walt Disney Company. Since 1981, when Nintendo introduced the Mickey Mouse Game & Watch, Disney had been dipping its toe into the business of video games. There had been a few notable efforts to develop games internally, but for the most part, the extent of Disney's toe-dipping entailed licensing out characters to unaffiliated developers. The list of licensees included Nintendo, who released a few Game & Watch titles, Sega, who crafted hits like Quackshot and Castle of Illusion, and most notably Capcom, who picked up the rights to several pieces of intellectual property in the Magic Kingdom way back in 1987. This clever acquisition was the work of Joe Marici, Capcom's forward-thinking VP of sales and marketing. Throughout the 1980s, Marici's claim to fame was that he had come up with the name Mega Man. The Japanese-created character had originally been christened Rockman. But by 1993, it would have been difficult for him to begin any bragging session without first mentioning Disney. Over the past 5 years, the combination of Capcom's talented developers and Disney's storied properties had resulted in hits like Mickey Mousecapade, 1987, DuckTales, 1989, and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, 1991. The relationship also led to The Little Mermaid, 1992, which was notable for being one of the first games designed for and marketed toward girls. It was a match made in heaven. But as Capcom continued to capitalize on these intellectual properties, Disney started to believe that maybe they should be the ones making these games and raking in the windfalls that followed. For Disney, the time to delve deeper into the video game industry couldn't have come at a better time. Although the company had an unparalleled reputation for making great animated films, it had been several years since Disney had produced a classic. With features like The Black Cauldron and The Great Mouse Detective, the 80s had been an underwhelming decade. But that trend changed in the 90s. The Little Mermaid rang in the new decade, Beauty and the Beast followed after that, and then came Aladdin. To capitalize on these hot properties, Disney entered into a partnership with Sega and Virgin Interactive, a third-party developer that Shinobu Toyota had recommended. These were already a million reasons why Kalinske was thrilled to be in business with Disney, but the relationship became even more vital when he learned about the government's recent interest in video games. If they did decide to get involved, Sega, and not Nintendo, would likely be the target. There was no denying that Sega aimed at an older audience, and there was no doubt that the folks in Washington would selectively overlook this fact. In the event that this really did come to pass, Kalinske wanted to have as many squeaky clean friends standing beside him as he could. So, what better way to announce the beginning of this beautiful relationship than a press conference at the Consumer Electronics Show? Jeffrey Katzenberg, the head of Walt Disney Studios, had a similar but much bigger idea. This was his first foray into video game publishing, and he wanted to make a splash, a Disney-sized splash. Katzenberg saw the original plans for the press conference, decided they were not grand enough, and then made arrangements for a press conference that fit his vision. What he provided was nearly magical. Katzenberg and Disney recreated Agrabah in a hotel in Las Vegas, complete with live animals, staged performances, and real palm trees. With speeches by Katzenberg and Kalinske, as well as a keynote by Virgin's founder Richard Branson, it was the event of the 1993 Winter CES. After the event, Katzenberg was amped up and excited, but also worried about how the industry would react to his game. There was also a strange variable that raised the stakes of Katzenberg's and Sega's game. Capcom, as per their previous licensing deal, was also releasing a version of Aladdin, this one for the Super Nintendo. All of this paraded through Kalinske's mind as he accompanied Katzenberg toward Sega's booth for the very first demo of the game. With everything at stake, Kalinske was a little bit nervous. He could have been much more nervous, however, if he had any idea what was going on with the actual game chip at that very moment. Video games at that time were written on EEPROMs, erasable, programmable, read-only memory chips. During Katzenberg's press conference, Diane Farnassier and the rest of the marketing team were to arrange Sega's kiosk and prepare an enticing setup for the demonstration of the Aladdin EEPROM. The problem was that as the press conference started, she realized that nobody had the EEPROM. The game was missing. In this pre-cell phone era, the team communicated on walkie-talkies, and after a mad, static-filled scramble, they eventually realized who had the game chip. It was a woman on Sega's marketing team, but unfortunately, she had not shown up that day. With time running out, Farnassier sent a team to her hotel room where they discovered her huddled over the toilet, red in the face and violently ill. After providing requisite concern, they eventually learned that the disc was in the hotel's safe, and then prodded her into remembering the combination between the graphic tirades of vomit. It was not pretty nor easy to forget, but they got the EEPROM and then rushed back to the show. Meanwhile, Katzenberg was on his way to the booth. Kalinske got a message from someone on a walkie-talkie to stall Katzenberg from arriving at the kiosk. He orchestrated about 10 good minutes of stalling, attempting to highlight the wonders of CES to a confused Katzenberg who was trying to lead the press to his game. The Disney movie mogul tried to break away, but Nilsson made a last-ditch effort to slow him down, getting Katzenberg to try riding one of Sega's racing simulator games, which bought about 5 more minutes. Finally, though, Katzenberg had had enough and took everyone to the booth for the demonstration. While he was in front of the booth talking about the challenges of creating a game that was true to the movie, the team arrived at the EEPROM and slipped it to Fernassier, who inserted it casually into the Sega Genesis on Katzenberg's cue as if nothing had happened. Aladdin went on to be named Best Genesis Game of 1993 by Electronic Gaming Monthly. Chapter 44. Crazy Like a Fox. As a whole new world melodically played from the speakers scattered around Disney's Vegas-based Agrabah, Nintendo's Tony Harmon couldn't help but agree with the message behind the theme song from the movie Aladdin. It was a whole new world indeed, he thought, as he watched footage from the game. So much of what Sega released was just well-packaged junk, but this game right here was an absolute gem. What made Sega's Aladdin different from the Capcom SNES version was that it had been built with a new style of graphics called Digicel Animation. This breakthrough, created by Virgin's David Perry and Neil Young, enabled hand-drawn film cells to be directly scanned into development software. As a result, they were able to work directly with Disney's animators and had access to over 250,000 cells from the movie throughout the development process. Harmon was awed by the final product, which looked and felt like it was controlling the protagonist from an animated film. Despite his mortal dislike of Sega, and his belief that with only 12 levels its lasting interest was limited, he had to admit that this was a game-changer. Just one man's opinion, of course, but Harmon's ability to evaluate video games was second to none. Arakawa valued these opinions so much that he assembled something called the Product Launch Committee, which was basically his way of getting the marketing guys, Main, White, Sackley, and Tilden, to speak with NOA's product development guy, Harmon, and discuss all aspects of a game's release. Things like which games deserve their own commercials, and how best to promote these titles in Nintendo Power. Harmon respected NOA's marketing staff, but it always floored him that not a single one of them was a gamer. Sure, these were businessmen, and it was true that one need not adore widgets in order to sell them effectively, but it also couldn't hurt, right? Like most people who love playing video games, Harmon secretly dreamed of one day creating a hit. And he finally got closer to that goal after Mr. Y's announcement at Shoshinkai of a Nintendo baseball game. Although most of Nintendo's games were made by Japanese developers, either by Nintendo themselves or by a third-party game maker in the region, for this baseball game, Harmon chose to look toward Europe. He'd been closely monitoring the technological advancements over there, and was greatly impressed by some of the work being done. Harmon's European fascination had already paid off handsomely once, by finding Argonaut Studios, which later developed the Super FX chip, and he expected to do so again, this time with a respected British publisher named Software Creations. Harmon had high hopes for his baseball game, and so did Nintendo of America, who was negotiating with Seattle Mariners superstar Ken Griffey Jr. to make him the face of this game. But as great a sports game as he believed that this would be, that's all it would ever be. A great sports game. Hopefully it would make a lot of money and provide countless hours of fun, but it would never be a classic like Super Mario Brothers or The Legend of Zelda. The even more secret dream behind Harmon's secret dream was to make a game starring one of Nintendo's iconic characters. It was an understandable desire, but Nintendo was so protective of those franchises and wouldn't let somebody outside Japan touch them. There was something admirable about this stance, but there was something almost racist about it as well. Nintendo didn't believe that anybody outside Japan could achieve greatness. Not only did Harmon believe that this could be done, but he also believed that by not taking this chance, Nintendo risked missing out on some of these breakthroughs, and seeing the Aladdin game at CES served as proof to him of this fact. So he decided to write a paper, a manifesto of sorts, that discussed the criteria of what makes a great game, and used this to prove that one could be made outside Japan. Bill White couldn't have cared less about where the games were made. All he cared about was that they were marketable, and that he be allowed to promote the hell out of them.
He had been given the autonomy to do so during his early years at Nintendo, the Wizard, the Pepsi deal, the Nintendo World Championships. But as time wore on, he increasingly got the feeling that he was being handcuffed. Nowadays, there wasn't much more to do than smile, nod, and spread Nintendo optimism. So while Harmon was wandering around the trade show, White was back at the company's massive booth trying to turn every piece of good news into headline-worthy greatness. "Christmas was phenomenal," he said, speaking to a reporter from Bloomberg. "Video games came back in unbelievable fashion, and it gives us tremendous momentum coming into 1993, where we expect hardware and software sales to rise by 19%. The reporter nodded, jotting this down. "Very impressive. But what does Nintendo have to say about its flagship 8-bit system, which has fallen considerably? You've gone from 9 million units sold in 1989 to less than 3 million this past year." "I look at that as positive," White said. "To continue sustaining sales of the original NES, when more people are buying the faster and more sophisticated Super Nintendo systems, to me, that speaks volumes about Nintendo's commitment to quality." "And what about CD-ROM technology?" the reporter asked. "Sega already has a system out there, and the 3DO company has recently announced plans to launch a CD-based system by end of the year." "That's a great question," White said. "Nintendo hopes to bring out a 32-bit CD-ROM accessory by the end of the year, but if we don't feel it meets our standards, it won't be released. In this environment, it's easy to get caught up in the arms race aspect of it all, but that's just not how we at Nintendo believe in doing business. That being said, our commitment to technology is second to none. Are you familiar with Nintendo's new Super FX chip?" White used this self-created segue to promote Star Fox and hype Nintendo's new franchise with comparisons to Star Trek and Star Wars. As the interview neared its end, the reporter asked White if he could pass along any materials to publish alongside the article. That would make sense, White thought, but alas, he could not. All exclusive content went first to Nintendo Power, so there was nothing to do but smile and nod. The handcuffs, they were feeling very tight these days. 1 month later, while White was fantasizing about a Houdini-esque escape, and Harmon was coming up with ways to improve upon Aladdin, Fernassier was desperately trying to avoid going to the bathroom. Her bladder was not particularly thrilled by this decision, but she felt like there was just too much at stake for her to leave the room, even if only for a minute. That's just how it went during Sega's annual planning meetings, and this one would prove to be particularly pivotal, as it led to the company's best year yet. "So there's a chance that Sonic 3 won't be ready for Christmas this year," Fernassier explained. "In an ideal world, Sega would release a new Sonic title every holiday season, but it was only January 1993, and Naka had already cautioned that the newest game might be late. Since Christmas tended to make or break a video game company's year, finding a potential replacement was a top priority." "I know I'm crazy for even asking this," Fernassier continued, "but is there by chance a consensus on what everyone thinks our best game will be for 93? Before she even finished asking the question, nearly every single person in the room was already shouting out a response. "Aladdin! Jurassic Park! Eternal Champions!" Not only were they just yelling the names of the games, but shipping quantities and suggested prices as well. It was a lot of noise, but Fernassier hadn't expected any less. The conference room was filled with all the top people from sales, marketing, and operations, as well as the producers for each of the upcoming year's games. Of course, each of them shouted out their own games, their job performances, and likely their annual bonuses, heavily dependent on the decisions made in this meeting. If large initial orders were placed for a game, and significant marketing dollars were put behind it, there was a strong chance it would be a hit. So Fernassier asking everyone in the room about the best game was kind of like Santa Claus visiting a first grade classroom and saying, "I have a finite number of gifts this year, so can you please tell me which kids have been the nicest?" "Okay, okay, okay," Fernassier said, trying unsuccessfully to quiet the cacophony. This is exactly why she couldn't go to the bathroom. Leave for just a second, and alliances would be formed, favors called in, and everyone would channel their inner bully. "Come on, let's all settle down."
"Quiet!"
Paul Ryo grunted, instantly shutting up the room. "How about we try a different approach?" Fernassier suggested.
Let's talk about Star Fox for a moment. Nintendo Star Fox would be coming out in March, and they were putting more behind this game than any they had ever released before. Not only would the folks in Redmond be shipping out a million units to more than 18,000 retailers, but they were also holding special citywide events in Atlanta, Cleveland, Dallas, Houston, Los Angeles, Salt Lake City, and Tampa. To disrupt the success of Nintendo Star Fox, Sega had scheduled the release of several top titles for around this time. Games like X-Men, Toe Jam and Earl 2, and Echo the Dolphin, the gorgeous end result of Ed Annunziata's Dolphin Fantasy from a couple years earlier. At this point, there was nothing more that Sega could do from a product standpoint. But Fournassier was curious if anything else could be done on the marketing front. We all know Star Fox is going to be big, but there's still time for us to shrink the size.
Thank God Nintendo didn't get this out for Christmas, someone from the marketing team said. Can you imagine?
You know, Richard Burns said, interrupting everyone's imaginations. I'm not so sure that's correct. There's a solid chance it would have gotten lost in Sonic Tuesday, and to be perfectly honest, the retailers I've spoken with aren't too upset about having a mini Christmas in March. It's actually something we ought to consider.
It's too late, someone from the product development team replied. We can't get anything else out by March, let alone anything big.
Yes, we can, Fournassier declared, her mind noticeably worrying. Well, not literally, of course, but Richard's got a great point. Of course the retailers are thrilled to get a bonus Christmas, so that's exactly what we should give them. A Christmas-like launch every month of the year.
Boom! Said Tom Abramson, slapping the table. Like it, love it, done deal. Just like the greeting card industry, every month we'll have something big going on.
Okay, every month was a little too aggressive, but every 6 to 8 weeks should do the trick.
Why didn't we come up with this sooner? Fournassier wondered. Especially since this resembled a similarly staggered promotional strategy from the consumer packaged goods industry.
But it didn't really matter that the idea had never come up before. All that mattered was that it worked like gangbusters when she was at Del Monte, and it should be just as effective now at Sega. And as the jockeying began for whose games should receive the full holiday treatment of promotion, marketing, and sales, Fournassier couldn't help but continue to ignore her bladder and be thankful that she hadn't gotten up to use the bathroom. If she had, she might have very well missed out on the gift of having Christmas all year round. Not long after that meeting, a man named Bob Knapp was on his way from Osaka to Newark. During the long trip from Japan to New Jersey, he had a layover in San Francisco, where he was greeted with some disturbing news at Gate 81.
"I'm sorry, sir," the airline attendant explained, "but that's what my system says."
"That can't be accurate," Knapp said. "My inbound flight was first class."
"Yep, it says that too," the attendant said. "But your final leg is economy."
"I see," Knapp replied. "Are there any upgrades available?"
"Yep, there's one," the lady beside him said.
It was Ellen Beth Van Buskirk, headed east for Toy Fair, and with the millions of miles she'd accumulated, there was no way she wasn't getting that seat.
"And it's about to be mine."
Knapp took a half step backward to fully observe this woman, and then a half step forward to plead his case. "I think it makes more sense for me to take the seat. I've just flown in from Osaka. I'm sure you understand."
"What?" Van Buskirk asked. "Are you crazy?"
"Hardly," Knapp said. And he and Van Buskirk then proceeded to argue over who most deserved the seat in question. Not long after, the bickering turned to banter, and then it evolved into flirtation. By the time the flight departed, Knapp had gotten the seat, but neither of them could wait to land in New Jersey, where they could continue to flirt with each other. In the following weeks, while Van Buskirk was busy falling in love at first argument, Tony Harmon finished writing his manifesto and came to the conclusion that a developer must have at least three things to make a great game. The first was a big budget, somewhere in the range of $3 million to $4 million, to ensure that corners were not cut. The second was coin-op experience, to truly understand the value of capturing a player's interest immediately. And the last was an iconic character, ideally one that has already been established, like Mario, or one steeped in its own captivating mythology, like Star Fox. Of course, it took much more than just these three things,
But this was the basis behind why companies like Capcom, Konami, and even Sega had a knack for making hits. Not long after Harmon finished the paper, Arakawa approached him with some unexpected travel plans.
"Tomorrow," he said, "you will be going to Japan."
"Okay," Harmon said, making it a point to never appear off guard in front of his boss.
"Any particular reason?"
"I sent your paper to Mr. Yamauchi, and he would like to see you."
And so, after a silent gulp, Harmon hopped on a flight with Arakawa and his wife, and 24 hours later, the three of them wound up inside Yamauchi's office.
"He is pleased that you could fit in this visit on such short notice,"
Yoko Arakawa explained to Harmon, translating for her father. Although Yamauchi's office was small, it was as intimidating as one would expect from Nintendo's quietly ruthless leader. It was really warm in there, somewhere around 80 degrees, and Yamauchi sat there in a white undershirt, his lower half hidden behind a large wooden desk. In front of him was a pristine coffee table, a small television, and a pair of couches on either side of the room. Some of the employees at NCL referred to his office as the realm of the mother brain, making a reference to the giant cranium-shaped energy-sucking villain who appears at the end of Metroid. Yamauchi often had guests in and out of his office, and today was no different. In addition to hosting his daughter, his son-in-law, and Tony Harmon, there as well on either side of the desk were Miyamoto, Yokoi, Takeda, and Sakamoto, each nobly standing upright and reluctantly sweating due to the room's toasty temperature.
"I have read your report and found it interesting enough to pass along to Nintendo's greatest experts,"
Yamauchi said, gesturing to the video game legends surrounding Harmon.
"It is their opinion that you are wrong, and that only the Japanese can make a great game."
"With all due respect," Harmon countered, with a noticeable amount of gall in his voice, "your experts, these men here, account for most of the best developers in the world. Most, but not all. And I truly believe that with the right resources, a great game could be made outside Japan." After the words were translated, peals of laughter permeated the room. Harmon continued to make his case, highlighting key points from his paper, and trying to appeal to Mr. Y's love of innovation, but ultimately appeared to be of no use.
"Face it," Yoko Arakawa finally said, "you're not going to win."
Harmon was prepared to leave with his tail between his legs, smiling, though, as his idea had made it all the way to the top. But he decided to try one more approach. "Let me just ask one more question," he said, taking a step toward Yamauchi. "How many bad television commercials do we make each year?" This was not a particularly tactful inquiry, but Harmon knew that and thought he knew Yamauchi well enough to believe this might make a dent. Everyone in the office tried to extrapolate the meaning of this question, but before any further clarification was requested, Yamauchi burst out in laughter.
"The answer? Many."
Harmon nodded. "And how much does each one of these commercials cost you?" Yamauchi quickly discussed this with the experts on his couches, and then came back with an answer.
"They say around 3 million.
Harmon nodded once again.
"Then why don't you give me $3 million in 1 year to make a great game? Maybe I'm wrong and won't succeed with this, but the worst case scenario is that you'll just make one less bad commercial."
At this, Yamauchi smiled, the finest and most silvery smile Harmon had ever seen. And then the legendary president of NCL stood up and accepted the deal, provided that this young American kept Miyamoto apprised of his progress.
"Progress?" Nilsson asked over lunch with Kalinske. "I don't have any progress to report. That's the problem."
"Don't be so hard on yourself," Kalinske replied. He'd known Nilsson for several years, but never seen him quite like this. The hustle and bustle of his new job was wearing him down. Kalinske wanted to cheer up his old friend, remind him that all those frequent flyer miles were for the good of this company they had built together. But he could tell from the haggard expression on Nilsson's face that he wasn't in the mood for remember whens.
"It'll get better before you know it. Just watch."
"But what if it doesn't?"
Nilsson asked, more sincerely than rhetorically. Kalinske assumed by this tone that he was fishing to see if getting back his old job was a possibility. Not that he necessarily wanted this, but Kalinske knew that Nilsson was the kind of guy who found power and pleasure in possibility. Kalinske also knew that if the conversation continued down this road, Nilsson probably wouldn't like where it went. The fact was that Fernassier was doing an excellent job, and whatever she lacked when it came to wild what-if ideas, she more than made up for with her strong management and communication skills. Make no mistake, Nilsson was a star, but with so many cooks now in Sega's kitchen, they needed a team player. That being said, Sega still needed Nilsson's star power, possibly now more than ever. But they needed it in different galaxies as the company expanded around the globe. "Al," Kalinske said, trying to help his friend shine, "you're the guy who made Buster Douglas a bigger star after he lost the title. If anybody can make this work, it's you." Nilsson nodded slowly, processing, not accepting. "But what if it doesn't?" "But why?" Arakawa asked Tilden, looking at the April 1993 issue of GamePro magazine. On the cover, right there in front of them, was artwork from Nintendo's Star Fox. Not only had this artwork been intended for Nintendo Power, but White had specifically met with Arakawa, Tilden, and Harmon to discuss sharing it with outside magazines, and had explicitly been told not to do so.
"I don't know," Tilden said. "I'm just as surprised as you are."
She was indeed incredibly surprised by this act of defiance, but her incredulity cannot be compared to Arakawa's. To him, such a gesture was just unfathomable.
"But why?"
Arakawa asked again, still stunned by the insubordination. Following this discovery, Arakawa tasked Peter Main with firing Bill White, making him the first executive to be let go since the NES launched in America. Main, however, did not want to dismiss White. Not only did he consider White an invaluable asset, but he admitted to Arakawa that he had given his protege permission to do what he had done. "You should fire me, if anything," Main offered, but Arakawa was not persuaded. This was not about chain of command, but about looking into someone's eyes and telling them no, only to find out that a direct instruction had been ignored and trust violated. His mind was made up. It was time for Bill White to leave Nintendo, and Peter Main would have to play the role of executioner. Chapter 45. Unacceptable. Hayao Nakayama looked closer at the final prototype of the Sega Pico. As he turned it over in his hands, inspecting it with a piercing look that was half glare and half stare, the R&D team members who had gathered in the conference room anxiously awaited his response. This portable edutainment device was scheduled to be released in Japan by early summer. So by this point in the process, gaining Nakayama-san's approval was more formality than necessity. The parts had already been ordered, and the molds had already been made. The Pico was happening whether the president of Sega liked it or not. But oh, how much they wanted him to like it, to see Nakayama-san give them a smile. He was stingy with those smiles. That was just his way, but when they came, it was well worth the wait. And as he put down the prototype, the room filled with a collective surge of hope. Nakayama-san, however, was not yet ready to deliver either a smile or a frown. Clearly the R&D team had done well, for the device looked impressive. This was a very important thing, because Tom Kalinske believed this product would be a winner. But the product also looked expensive, and he wanted to know how much it would cost to make. Better yet, he wanted to know what the retail price would be. A sequence of stares around the table finally led to an answer. Someone suggested 15,000 yen, maybe 20,000, somewhere in that range, about $150 to $200. As Nakayama-san processed this information, he picked up the Pico once again. 15,000 yen? For this? But why? Tom Kalinske had said that it needed to sell for $100, for at that price he can make it into a sensation. Tom had said that very clearly, and these employees had been there when he said it. There was no excuse to be made. None. Suddenly, Nakayama-san smashed the device against the table. This was unacceptable. He lifted it up and smashed it again. Unacceptable. Another smash, louder this time. Unacceptable. Over and over, until the silly blue thing was busted to pieces. And still he continued, smashing the machine until the message was made abundantly clear. Chapter 46. Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Come on, Kalinske said with disbelief, leaning over his desk with the phone to his ear. You must be exaggerating.
If anything, I'm doing the opposite, Fisher claimed. What's the opposite of exaggerating?